All right. So, good morning. Sorry I'm late. All right. So today we are, and remember there's no class on the 30th. Our next class is December 14th. So you have a lot of time between, you have a lot of time to read Herzl's novel, Overland. Yes. Yes, you do that. Alright, so for next time, you need to get yourself a copy of Theodor Herzl's novel, Old New Land, and read that. Okay? It's a utopian novel. It'll take you probably about 2 hours. It's short. It's not very good, but it's easy to read. The syllabus that I sent you most recently has it on there. Okay? So the thing to ask yourself, Herzl's novel is about basically his vision of what he calls the new society. It's really his vision of what he thought this Palestinian Jewish state would look like, or this Jewish state in Palestine, I should say. And he focuses on three things that you should think about in this new society. One is the politics of it, right? This idea of trying to build a Jewish and democratic state. Two is what he calls mutualism, which is this vision of a socioeconomic order that is sort of one part capitalist and one part socialist. And three is the cultural, spiritual question of what's going to be Jewish about this place. How is it? What are the Jewy aspects of it? Okay? In what way is it Jewish? Is there ritual? Is there observance? A temple rebuilt? What's Passover like? Shabbat, stuff like that. So if you focus on those three things, I mean, the novel is very easy to grasp. Some of you may have read this kind of stuff in college or in other places. You know, the turn of the century, there was this kind of genre of people writing these utopian novels, looking backward, poverty and progress, Jules Verne stuff, people writing these sort of almost like proto sci-fi things. The world was changing pretty dramatically by 1900. Cities were getting much bigger. Technology was beginning to have a little more of an impact on people's everyday life. And so one of the responses to that in a kind of a literary, intellectual way was to sort of think about, creating this kind of counter reality. That's what the utopian novel is in some way. So he's a part of a larger genre. But it's also this kind of funny combination of utopian as in a counter-reality, but also a planning document. Right? This is kind of what he wants to see Israel become. And he's trying to orient Zionism in that direction. The reason why I'm giving you this to read is just because I think it's, first of all, reading fiction is always fun. And second of all, I think it's actually the best single window into his mind, much more than these other sort of boring essays and talks that he gave that are much more wonky. It really fleshes out for you a kind of a picture of what he imagined Zionism to be, number one. Number two, the thing that is kind of amazing is that even though, he writes this, it's published in 1902, and obviously Zionism is, really in its infancy at that point, and the State of Israel isn't created until 1947. What's amazing is those three things, the Jewish and democratic state, meaning a political vision, the social vision of this kind of weird combination of socialism and capitalism, and this whole sense of what the Jewish social contract is, in what way is it secularism, what way is it religious, what does that really look like, how do these people talk to each other. What's amazing is how much of those are, in some ways, those are still the issues that organize Israel. Israel is really very much about those three issues: being Jewish and democratic, being socialist and capitalist, and this kind of weird thing about, you know, secular Tel Aviv and religious Jerusalem kind of thing. So I think you'll enjoy it. Again, it's not a great work of fiction, but it's not terrible. It's not painful to read, and you'll really get a window into his head. So that's what you should do. That's what you should do for our next meeting on the 14th. There are other things that are listed in that week, but concentrate on the 9th. Okay, and it's available in paperback, you know, for a couple of dollars on Amazon or eBooks, so it's very easy to find. I have in the Dropbox. I haven't finished Xeroxing the whole thing. I think I maybe had brought it at one of the classes. There is a, for those of you who are book collectors, there is a kind of a coffee table sized edition of this novel that was published in Haifa about 1960. And what's cool about that edition is that, you know, Israel was really only about 13 years old at that time. And they published this edition to be kind of a commemorative edition, which was their way. And what they do is, in any place where he's talking about a power plant or this or that, they have a picture from Israel of that thing. And it's really their way of saying, look how much of his vision we actually kind of built out. So what's cool for us, you know, reading this in 2015, is that in effect that edition becomes kind of like a double book, because it's his book from 1902, but it's also a book from Israel of 1960, and it gives you a sense of, oh, this is the way they kind of thought about what they were doing and what they were accomplishing. So for those of you, again, who like to collect coffee table books or coffee table books about Israel, go on Amazon or eBooks and you can find it. There are a lot of used copies that are available. 1960 Haifa. I have two chapters of that book in the Dropbox, and I'll send you a link to that. I hope before I go to England on Thursday I can Xerox the rest, but I can't promise I'm going to be able to do that. But I will send you the link. Okay, any questions or comments about the Herzl thing? Okay. All right, welcome. Alan, does everybody know Alan? Alan Siegel? Alan, you want to introduce yourself?
But I've known David, I don't know how long.
A while.
Time for a mitzvah, so.
Yeah, right.
anyway, I knew you guys were doing the Mayah preceding this, and then people told me about Salem, so I thought I would join it, but when I joined it, I knew I was going to miss the first three classes, so here we
go. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good to have you. Okay, so today we are talking about... We are talking about precursors and a little bit of the first Aliyah, right? That's where we got to for today. Anybody want to summarize what we did last time in terms of this notion of this kind of first stage of figures? I've got to get a noise magic mark. Anybody want to summarize what we did in terms of these sort of early proto-Zionist types, these precursor people, Moses Hess, Alkali, Kalischer, what are we talking about there? Oh, thank you, Allison. I didn't even think about those in the back. Stupid me. Anybody want to summarize?
Thank you.
What's a precursor? Silence. First rule of teaching, never fear silence. stressing you out? I'm sorry.
I'll take a
step. Yeah. Laura, thank you.
I think, well, I guess religious Judaism believes in the Messiah and return to Israel.
Okay.
And I think they have a much more practical approach, and they say, well, man has to pave the way for the Messiah. So it's more the Messiah as a metaphor.
Okay.
Just is a more practical, modern way of looking at religion than actually believing that someone's going to come down and make it happen.
Right, and so the context, first of all, Alkali and Kalisher are who? What kind of people are these guys?
Rabbis.
They're rabbis. And the texts that we read of them are basically sort of almost like you could imagine them being sort of like a Bar Torah. They're talking about something that they think is spiritually and socially important in Jewish life in the middle of the 19th century, which is Jews returning to the land of Israel. So this is, I think, is the backstory to what Laura just said. Why is it such a big deal for these rabbi people to be talking about human beings, Jews, actively trying to resettle the land of Israel? What's the theological backstory? Remember, we looked at that Babylonian Talmudic story, and that said that human beings should do what vis-a-vis the land of Israel? What should they do and not do?
They should stay together.
Where? Cheryl?
Where they are.
How come? Remember what the Babylonian Talmud says?
No.
What does it say? What is the reason why you should stay where you are? Newton,
so
Babylonia.
People can find
you.
Community.
Well, you've already built a community. Right? Jeremiah said, look, why were the Jews in places like Babylonia to begin with?
They were in exile.
Good. This is a theological category of existence. Right? That was the way the Jews made sense of something bad happening, which was the temple being destroyed and them suffering this kind of huge political and military defeat, which was rather than just saying, oh, you know what, this is a secular event. Right? Like the thing that happened in Paris. We don't think of that as being theological in nature. We think that this is a political conflict between different groups. Yes, religion is driving the political conflict, but fundamentally this is a political conflict between different groups, different societies, different people who have different goals, and it shows up in a political kind of a way. We don't think of this as somehow God is present in this story. We think that the people, and if anything, the opposite, we think the people who invoke God are the wackos. Right? We don't really know how to make room in our worldview for, oh no, in fact, this is a theological conflict, even though it's pretty clear that in some profound way it is. But the Jews could have said in 586 before the Common Era, you know what? This is not about God. This is about the fact that we are a small state and we were defeated by a larger state, namely the Babylonians. They defeated us, they burned down our temple, and we got to deal with that. That's a political problem we have to deal with. Jeremiah doesn't say that. What he says instead in his prophecy is, no, in fact, this is a theological problem. We sinned, and God, in effect, deploys the Babylonians as his messenger, as his vessel, his vehicle for imposing a theological judgment upon you. Okay? We don't really like this kind of language, and we don't really like that set of understandings of things. And we always recoil when we get these crazy things in our news feed about, oh, something happened terrible in Israel, and some idiot rabbi somewhere says, that's because people's mezuzahs weren't kosher. Like, we always think, you know, those people are total cretins, they're not my kind of rabbi, etc., etc. That's not the way we process reality. We don't like to think that people get sick for theological reasons. We don't like to think that bad things happen to good people. Rabbi Kushner's famous question, for theological reasons. We're sort of theologically tone deaf around this kind of stuff. But it's hard to read the prophets without realizing that is the way they processed reality, which is that Rabbi Soloveitchik once said that, you know, reading theology and history is like looking at an oriental carpet from the backside or the front side. We see it from the backside. We don't see the pattern. We think it's about politics and economics and this and that and the other thing. We don't see the real pattern, which is God's hand in history. That's what the prophet does. The prophet sees the oriental carpet from the right side. They see what the pattern really is. And that's what Jeremiah is saying. Jeremiah is saying, you shouldn't think that you got your temple destroyed just because you were weaker than the Babylonians. They had more divisions than you. The temple was destroyed because you sinned, and you're being punished. And the question then becomes, what is the response? The response is to hunker down in these different communities, and basically to accept your exilic state, and to sort of double down on that and hang in there until God decides to do what? Which is what Laura said a few minutes ago. God decides to do what?
Return you,
redeem you. Like, these are the huge words in Jewish theological life, right? Return, right? Tshuva, repentance, geulah, right? And the question then becomes, how is that actually going to happen? The story that we read in the Babylonian Talmud basically says, bottom line is, you don't really know how it's going to happen. What you know is that you are not going to be the ones to make that happen via human, sort of, quote-unquote, secular activity. Right? Somebody once joked, you know, he said, I knew my parents were Jewish when I was a kid because they went to meetings all the time. Right? Like, that's the what we think of, like, you have a problem. Right? You go to meetings, you organize groups, you do stuff as professionals, as lay leaders, and the like. The whole presumption of that is this kind of very humanistic mentality that says people can solve problems, get off your butt, get your act together, and solve problems. Jeremiah, in some ways, is saying the exact opposite, which is, this is a problem you can't solve. The only thing you can do as a kind of a counter problem solving move is to double down on where you're living and build strength. First guys are the ones who are saying, as Laura said, we are beginning to rethink what these categories, what these words mean. Things like redemption, return, and the like. Now, they're rabbis. So they're doing this from a religious perspective, right? And they're kind of ducking the obvious issue, which is what Laura raised, which is, wait, I thought the Babylonian Talmud said, you know, it's not okay to plan for Israel. It's okay to plan for Boston, for Babylonia, for anywhere else Jews live, to build strong community there. It's not okay to plan to return. How do they get around that? Remember? I mean, if we take a quick look at the first one is Alkali. He's the Sephardic rabbi from the Balkans. He says, I'm on page 105 of Hertzberg. Okay, the third redemption. You guys have this book, the Zionist Idea? Okay, you have to bring this. The third redemption. He says, it is written in the Bible, return, O Lord, unto the tens and thousands of the families of Israel. Okay? And then he proceeds to sort of lay out the case for human return. Okay, what kind of a document is it when a rabbi starts off by quoting a verse from the Bible? What does that sound like? What's he doing?
He's trying to persuade.
He's trying to persuade you. And what genre is that? What would we call that? Jewy language? What genre is that? You start off a talk by quoting a verse from the Bible? A Dvar Torah. Right? He's giving, like, this is my bar mitzvah. This is today, you know, my parsha. You know, Isaac finds a wife named Rebecca, and here's a verse from the Bible, and I'm going to talk about it, and then I'm going to thank my parents, and I'm going to exit stage left. Like, this is what a Dvar Torah is. A Dvar Torah is you have a point you want to make that is ostensibly about the Bible, but in many ways it's really not about the Bible. It's really about you. It's about whatever it is you're thinking about. It's about ISIS. It's about Obamacare. It's about, you know, the occupied territory. You know, whatever it is, you have something that's on your mind and you want to sort of hook it back to a reading of the Bible. That's what a Dvar Torah is. Right? So this is what this guy is doing. He's giving a Dvar Torah. He has a point that he wants to make, which is the point that Laura made a few minutes ago, which is he's saying something that is a little bit radical, which is that Jews can go back to Israel and they can try to make that happen. But notice how he does it. What's the technique he employs? Is he doing it like, is he totally naked out there without any support? What's he doing?
The Bible is the truth.
He's saying, oh, the Bible tells me, because this is the way you legitimize any argument in Jewish life. You find a textual precedent for it. There's a way in which Jewish life is this very funky combination, always, of continuity and discontinuity, in the sense of you by definition are trying to do something new. You're trying to build a day school. You're trying to argue for moving to another community. You're creating some element of disruption, right? The business school types would talk about this whole notion of creative disruption, right? Innovation. Innovation is always disruptive. If you didn't need to do something new, so you'd be doing the old thing. The question is how you see the new in the context of the old. And what Jews typically do to, in effect, smooth over the differences between the new and the old is, I'm going to find a verse in the Bible to hook it back to. Which is my way of saying, you know what, maybe it's not so discontinuous after all. That could be a total lie, by the way. That could be, I mean, largely beside the point. It could be, in fact, quite radical, but you're trying to make it more palatable to people, including, by the way, people who might be sitting there in the pews listening. They don't want the radical. They want the continuity. And the way to do that is by some of these gestures like voting, you know, versifying, right, alluding to something from a scriptural source. So, what's radical about him is that I think this whole piece of human activity, right? Jews are going to have to go back to the land of Israel, but what's not radical, it seems to me, or what's potentially radical is this notion of, he's still using terms like Messiah, return, redemption, right? That's the traditional side of it. And I think that really begs the question in Zionism in general, you know, to what extent is it about continuity and to what extent is it about discontinuity, right? It's continuity in the sense of, he's talking about the land of Israel, and he's talking about Jews. It's discontinuous because it's really about the notion of humans doing it and not God doing it. And so I think that kind of dialectic is sort of built into it really from the beginning. Now, in what ways is this a very early text? I mean, how much of this, I mean, when you read this, was this a kind of a planning document for building a Zionist state? What's he accomplishing? What are these early guys accomplishing and not accomplishing? Right? They're talking about the need to return, but you get a sense of, oh yes, and we know exactly what to do. Let's go off and do it now. What's your sense of that? Or is it so long ago you don't really remember what they said?
No, it's more vague. It's not as specific, and it's more about, we know that we need to do it slowly,
right.
We need to do
good.
It big, but it doesn't get into the real specifics.
Yeah, no, Robin's exactly right. It's really not a planning document. It's really, again, it's sort of like three-quarters Dvar Torah, and I'd say one-quarter, and we ought to be doing this and this and this, but it's really sort of long on the exhortation kind of piece and short on the planning piece. It's the middle of the 19th century. A fair question anytime you read anybody is, who cares? Like, why are we reading this? Was anybody paying attention? Or was this, you know, sort of the tree falling in the forest and nobody hearing it kind of thing? I mean, were people paying attention in the middle of the 19th century? What are Jews doing in Europe in the middle of the 19th century? What's their life generally about?
Survival,
like it's so terrible, middle of the 19th century? What's going on? What are Jews trying to accomplish in mid-19th century Europe?
And like, they're merchants, they're living their lives, yeah. They're living amongst...
They're doing their thing, especially, and again, if we leave out the Pale of Settlement, where most Jews did live, in Tsarist Russia, and life is not so good there, like, and a lot of it is survival, because Russia's so poor, it's so backward, but certainly Jews in places like the Balkans, or Jews in Germany, Rabbi Kalischer is from Western Poland, Eastern Germany. Those Jews are trying to do what we're doing. They're trying to become merchants, they're trying to become middle class, they're hoping that their kids are going to become maybe professionals, go to university. That is not so different from us. So, all of a sudden, you go to shul one day, like you stumble into shul, or, you know, for some insane reason, you know, your family's driving you crazy, and you say, "Oh, I'm going to go to mincha today. Get the hell out of the house." So you go to mincha, and there's some guest speaker from Sarajevo who gives this Devar Torah about how Jews ought to go back to the land of Israel. I mean, how are you hearing that? It's some synagogue in Sofia, in Bulgaria, or Budapest. Right? You're going to come home and you know, "Oh, honey, what did the rabbi talk about?" "Oh, there was this guest from Sarajevo, and he gave a talk about going back to the land of Israel." How are you going to respond to that? Huh? Yeah, like, "Oh, that sounds very nice, you know. I'm going to the gym tomorrow morning, I have a Pilates class, how is that relevant to you?"
He's planting the seed.
He is trying to plant the seed. It may totally go over your head because it's so out of context for you. You're focused on, "Oh yeah, my bright son Sigmund, you know, got admitted to the University of Vienna Medical School class." Like, that's where your head is. We're going back to hell? Like, well, no, absolutely not. Like, I'm so excited. We have a chance to, you know, make a bid on a very nice apartment in the center of Vienna. Like, I'm totally not focused on what this guy is saying. So there is a kind of a disconnect, probably, between the actual texture of Jewish life in a place like Vienna or Budapest or Berlin or what have you, or even in a small town, if you're living in a village in Bavaria somewhere. How are you going to plug into this? So there is a way in which these guys are sort of talking to themselves. And the other piece of context is, so then why are they doing it at all? Because what's going on in general in 19th century European political life? What's happening? Right? They would lead these guys in places like the Balkans or Germany to be talking about Jewish nationalism, because who else is talking about nationalism? Who's doing it? What's going on in nationalistic activity? I mean, is nationalism a big thing in European life? Absolutely.
Everybody is. It's changed from the Ottoman Empire
Well, it's changing. Yeah. Right? It's changing inside of all these empires. Look, Europe, you're going to see what a magnificent draftsman I am now. This is Europe. Okay, the boot is down here. This is Italy. Right? So this is France. This is Spain. This is Germany. Switzerland. All these crappy little countries here. Here's Austria and Hungary. Here's the Balkans. Here's Russia. Okay. And this is the Ottomans. Not very many countries. It's really just a few because you have these huge empires: France, Germany, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, right? And then this is Africa down here. So what's happening in all these places? Here's the, I said the boot. So here's Italy, Germany, the middle of the 19th century. Germany and Italy go through a unification process. What was in Italy prior to Italy? What Italy consists of? A bunch of those little regions that we are so, oh, I rented a house in Tuscany, I'm going there, very nice. Going to go to see the Palio in Siena, right? So Italy is unified. What was in Germany prior to Germany? Same thing, a bunch of little states, Prussia, Bavaria, right? So these Jews are watching unification and nationalistic activity going on all over Europe. Right? That's just like a core activity. Now, a more specific question is, was nationalism good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? How so?
Because they were not a part of any of these nations. They were always...
Why not, Laura?
Because they were always the outsider.
What are the criteria that you were implicitly referring to that would lead you to think that nationalism would be a kind of an othering activity that would include some people and exclude others? Because that's implicitly what you're relying upon, it seems to me. So what are the categories of nationalism, the markers of it that would lead you to that conclusion? What's nationalism about?
Well, the fact that you were born in the country, that you have civil rights, voting, and, you know, let's say taxes, and you have the rights and obligations.
Okay, so civil stuff, law. What else? What else? What else?
Ancestry?
Alan said religion, I think. Ancestry?
Pride, culture.
Culture? What else?
Land ownership.
Okay, land. So, how many of these are material as opposed to sort of like emotional, affective kinds of things? Right? You've got a bunch of them that are material, like voting, land, and so, you know, left out economics, right? But politics, economics, law, those are very material. And theoretically, those could be super open and democratic. That's kind of the American way of thinking about it. Okay, well, what about stuff like, nobody mentioned blood. Somebody mentioned origins. Blood, language, religion, culture, history. Are those objective? Not so much. Those are more emotional, cultural meaning kinds of things. Part of the big question in nationalism is nationalism going to be about building a state of laws, civil spaces, where people can in effect create new identities together? Or is nationalism going to be about stuff like who your parents are, where you come from, what language you speak, blood, origin, culture, language? What's the difference?
Well, one is achievable and the other is not. You're either in it or you're not.
Exactly. Exactly right. One is achievable. One is, and this is the American, like my daughter and I just saw that Tom Hanks movie yesterday about the Cold War.
Bridge of Spies.
Bridge of Spies. And, you know, he's talking about, at one point, he's talking about the fact that what's so great about America is that everybody comes from somewhere else, and at some level, nobody cares about that. Because the point is, the only thing that happens here, the only thing that really matters here is, do you commit to the Constitution? As long as you're willing to commit to the Constitution, you can be a member of this civic reality we call being a member of the American people. There is no American people in the way there's a German people, the way there's a French people. So part of what is, I think, confusing for Jews and other people too, about nationalism is that nationalism on its best days is this beautiful kind of radical idea of building new states with new identities that people can actually share in and kind of construct together. And you are not the prisoner of who your parents were. Nobody cares about the fact that you go home to some crappy little apartment on Blue Hill Avenue in 1925 and talk to people who can't even read the Boston Globe because they don't know English. Nobody cares about that in school, in public school. That's the beauty of the American vision. That an Italian kid and a Jewish kid and a Polish kid can come from these different crappy apartments and they can go into a school and they can become one. And that's a beautiful thing. Okay, but on the other hand, if your view of life is, no, but the part of life that maybe I cherish the most is stuff like land or language, culture, religion, and the like. The beautiful part of that is it's super, super tight for the people inside, but the question is, what about for everybody else? It's a much more balkanized view of reality in terms of, well, yeah, but wait, you know, if we want, what was it called? Bilingualism. How do you build a society where the Polish kid and the Hispanic kid and the Jewish kid and the Italian kid say, no, but I want special instruction to deal with my own cultural stuff in, you know, PS 101. Like, how are you gonna build a society like that? How are you gonna run a school like that? So part of the challenge for Jews is that most nationalism is going in which direction? Towards the parochial and the emotional and the cultural, or towards the civil, democratic, kind of brave new world we're all building the civil space together, kind of nationalism. What's most nationalism going, trending towards?
The former.
The former. And that's the problem. The problem is that it's going towards the emotional, cultural stuff. That's exciting to the people inside, and it's alienating to the people outside. And part of the backstory to these early Jewish national guys is they're in effect saying, you know what, we're not going to fit in to nationalism as it is trending towards the more parochial. And so what is the only response, what's the only move that we can therefore make?
Start our own.
We don't exactly know how we're going to pull that off, and we don't exactly know what it's going to look like, but the bottom line is, if Germany is going to be about a place that's about German blood, and of course also post-1859 is when Darwin published his Origin of the Species, so people are thinking in these kind of organic evolutionary ways, and they're applying in this very mischievous, pseudo-serious way, they're applying Darwinian notions to the origin of human communities as well, races and cultural communities. You know, people feel like, look, you know what, I'm not going to fit in here. I'm not going to fit into the new Germany. I'm not going to fit into the new Italy, necessarily. And so, the bad news is, it means that Europe is beginning, and of course, again, you're watching this right now. I mean, think about all the pieces about dealing with refugees, forget about the craziness of ISIS, but just this sense of, you know, how do you have a state that is very much about a national group, and yet it is somehow permeable, porous around having outsiders come in. Not so simple to figure out how to engineer that on a public policy level, but also on a cultural identity level too, it seems to me. So the bad news for Jews is that nationalism is becoming much more problematic. The good news is, in some ways, it is spurring some of them to think, well, maybe we ought to do this also. And this is, it seems to me, the beginning of the conversation, so that when we talk about these precursor folks, they're not very important in the sense of what they actually accomplished, but they represent a kind of a beta, a sort of like a pre-1.0 version, where they are at least saying, you know what, nationalism is happening, and the question is, what do we learn from that? And the answer is, maybe we ought to start doing it ourselves. Questions or comments so far? Okay. Hess. Did you read Hess, Roman Jerusalem? Right. Hess is the socialist. Okay. So, very quickly, Hess is in some ways much more interesting. He's on Roman Jerusalem is page 120, 119. Moses Hess was had been a socialist. He'd been a buddy of Karl Marx. What is the appeal of socialism for Jews? Most of us in this room are either half-hearted or totally enthusiastic capitalists, so we may be sort of tone-deaf to this. But what is the appeal of socialism to Jews? I'm not saying Jews, like, by the millions were attracted to socialism, but clearly it is significant in modern Jewish history. And Jews play a significant role in the history of socialism. That is true. What's the appeal?
That everyone will be taken care of.
Okay.
The government will provide, and that we'll all be, no one will be super rich or super poor, and everyone will be taken care of, and there'll be organizations within the community.
Okay, so the state is a piece of it, like a big state taking care of everybody.
Yes.
Would that be particularly appealing to Jews, or is that just like a human need that everybody at some point freaks out and says, you know what, inequality freaks me out, and I like the idea of a big state and a big safety net kind of thing. Is that particularly appealing to Jews, or not necessarily, or is there another piece there? What do you think? Why would Jews glom onto socialism any more than any other human being who just likes the idea of people living in a kind of egalitarian, equalitarian universe where fairness is not an issue? Yeah?
Member of the upper class.
Excuse me?
Member of the upper class.
Meaning what?
That they could get a piece of the action. They couldn't have land ownership. There were lots of restrictions on them. So it gave them the opportunity then.
Okay, so maybe a more fairness, equality gestalt is going to resonate more for outsiders. I think that for sure that's true on some level. You're more focused on your disabilities, right? The ways in which society closes you out. So by definition, you want more access. It could be access to capital, and that's back to the capitalism piece. You want to be able just to compete. Or you might say, no, you know, in fact, the society is fundamentally unfair, and the only way that we're ever really going to deal with unfairness is to build a fairer society, and then you're back to socialism. Right, because capitalism, the problem with capitalism, as we know, is that it's very good at generating wealth, it's not so good at distributing it. And sooner or later, freedom is actually affected by the extent to which some people have a lot more resources than others. Some people can call up Congressman Kennedy and get their phone call returned in 20 minutes, and some people are never going to get their phone call returned. So it's fair to ask, in fact, am I equally free when this guy doesn't know who I am and he knows who my neighbor is, you know, who lives $3 million away from me, kind of thing, in a different part of Newton. So that is a legitimate question, right? To what extent does inequality actually affect the quality of people's freedom? So yes, socialism is one kind of an answer to that social problem. That social question. On a deeper level, how is socialism an answer to the problem that Jews might be focused on? Yeah?
I think it allows the religious people to study and not work and still be supported by society.
Here you go again, talking about my nephew. Yes, well, this is a huge problem in Israel, obviously. Right? The extent to which the state is, and frankly, you guys, is clueless donors don't necessarily get this. You know, we're enabling people to basically do nothing, including my nephew, who I love dearly. He should live and be well.
Yeah,
but with a job. With a job.
His perspective is not that. Not that I agree with it necessarily. Yeah. He thinks he's doing a great
job. Absolutely. He's being a Glomden. He's studying Torah and he's spreading Torah. No, absolutely. Yes, it enables other kinds of activity to go on, which sort of goes back to the safety net piece that maybe, and you'll see this in the novel. You know, I mean, again, if you think about, for example, Charles Dickens, right, the world of a Dickens novel, like this sort of sense of darkness in a place like London. People toil, 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 they never get ahead. There's something very ugly and kind of grimy about life, like not for the rich people, obviously, but for most people who are not rich, life is going to be super hard, it's going to be super grimy. It's not going to last very long, and it's going to be pretty unpleasant. So socialism obviously speaks to that in terms of people being able to have other sets of pursuits that they never get to have. That's also, by the way, going back to the utopian novel thing, you know, this sense of, it's one thing to be poor in the countryside, at least you can see a flower once in a while. You're living in a, you know, in a workhouse in London, you're never going to see a flower. You're going to see ugliness. So, yes, this whole sense of, like, we could kind of reorient life around things like beauty, that's a very nice idea. Yeah?
Yeah, but doesn't some of the socialists feeling come from biblical text itself. I mean,
yeah.
You're supposed to leave the corner of the field for
yes.
the widow and the orphan, so this is a way
good.
To accomplish that.
So, some, right, so that back to the Dvar Torah piece, some people would say, I read classical Jewish texts as kind of like a proto-socialist thing. I mean, people argue about this. People argue for, you know, capitalism and socialism from inside the Bible. It's sort of a kind of a, you know, a kind of a clunky exercise in reading, but yes, absolutely, people would say that the Bible points me towards a very different kind of reality, and so I think that I'm actually doing something very Jewish by trying to kind of strike a blow for a more egalitarian society, whatever that means. The other piece of socialism, it seems to me, that is relevant to this, in some ways, socialism makes a huge claim that completely reorients society in a way that it will deal with the problem of anti-Semitism in the most basic structural way by saying, look, you know what? When you think about the categories that organize your life, right? You think, oh, it's about religion and class and color and vocation and region, and all these different things. Socialism basically comes along and says, there's only one category that really matters, and that's class. Most of your life is a function of how much money you have. And most of your life is a function of, to use Marxian language, do you control the means of production? Do you make stuff? Do you make stuff for you? Or do you make stuff for somebody else? The sewing machine with which you make an article of clothing, who owns the sewing machine? Do you own it, or does a guy, the man, does the man own it? And what Marx was saying from a very scientific perspective was, you know, these are sort of laws of the way economics work. And in some ways, that's the most fundamental category of all, which is, you know, do you control what you make? That's what structures your world. Everything else, religion, politics, culture, are in some ways false. They're kind of like shallow. They're superficial. So what's the diagnosis of anti-Semitism according to a socialist perspective? Is anti-Semitism real from a socialist perspective? If you assume that class is the only category that really matters, the relationships between economic classes, so then how do you explain racism or anti-Semitism? What is it? Marcia, you're a Southerner. Okay? You should be. So you grew up with racism. You saw it around you.
No, I'm going to say opposite. Because when I went to school with black kids.
But I'm saying you knew about it. You knew that race was a category in Southern life. How would socialism explain the problem of racism? Why is it that poor whites in rural Mississippi didn't see that the people with whom they had the most in common with were poor blacks instead of rich whites? Why is that? How would socialism explain that fact?
You're always aspiring for better, so you gotta put somebody
Okay, maybe some of it is aspirational. You want to be the rich planter instead of the poor white trash person. But why else? I mean, that's true for sure, aspirationally speaking. But why else? Why would the poor white not see that his fate was really bound up with the fate of the poor black, as opposed to the rich planter?
Do they blame them for that?
Yeah. How did that work?
I don't know.
How did that work?
Approach, because you had like 3 million people living in Russia in poverty and suffering from the rungs and
right.
It was a terrible situation for the Jews. And yes, there were the Western European Jews, and somehow they had to realize that they were going to, if they're going to move all the Jews and create a new land in Israel, it had to be, you know, you had to start somewhere, and the rich Jews were going to have to support the poor Jews, and, you know, everyone's going to have to work together as a community, and if you want to call it socialism or, you know, the kibbutz approach, but it was just like a pragmatic approach that created this philosophy that everyone's got to work together, and
right.
There was nothing in Israel.
But
there was
right.
Tel Aviv at that time.
But if you, okay, but look, so Amy's raising the specter of, you got millions of poor Tebbutites. The question is, what do you do for Tebbut? Assuming that you actually care. In other words, assuming that you don't just say, well, you know what, I can't help Tebbut. All I can help is my own family. Right? Assuming that you don't say in a more sort of like Ayn Randy way, like, I can't help Tevye, all I can do is do my own thing. And whatever that is, that's what I'm going to do. Assuming you care about the Tevyes of the world, so the question is, what do you do with them? Because that's, in some ways, that's really what Amy's asking. Right? What should we have done? There are millions of Jews who are suffering. It's true. The irony is, these guys, Alf, Light, Malisher, and Hess, none of them in some ways are really dealing with that. None of them are in Tsarist Russia. Right? The Balkans' life wasn't so bad. Places like Sarajevo, where Rabbi Alkali was. He's dealing with a whole national issue. He's like, all these national groups are kind of trying to get their mojo around organizing themselves and getting out from under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Ottomans, or whatever. Rabbi Kalischer in Western Poland, Eastern Germany, he's not dealing with such poor Jews there. And Hess is also a Central European Jew. So assuming you turn your gaze to the east and you look and you see all these Jews in the shtetl, they're poor, they're getting poor. Some of you may know infant mortality in this period is declining. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? The decline of infant mortality. Huh? Bad or good? Decline of infant mortality. Good meaning? Okay. It's of course, God forbid, nobody wants to lose a child, right? So God forbid you should lose children. It's an incredibly painful thing, obviously. But of course, the decline of infant mortality would mean what? More people. More mouths to feed. So, in terms of the calculus of people's lives, super problematic, right? Instead of 4 kids, you got 6. And you can't feed 4, much less 6. So, that's problematic too. Jewish population is exploding in this period. So the question is, okay, you got to deal with Tevye. You got millions of Tevye. The question is, what is the solution? That's really what Amy's asking.
Liberalism is going to work for the Tevyes because they've never been given a chance.
That's right. Because Russia's too backwards. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit when we talk about Katya Pinsker, but yes, most people would say liberalism assumes that you are living in America, not Haiti or Tsarist Russia. In a place where you got no social capital, you got no infrastructure, you got no capacity, you can't just go in there like, oh yes, I brought down 5 guys from Harvard Business School to talk about building social. Like, well, what? Totally irrelevant. to Haiti. You're talking about very poor societies. The structural pieces, the cultural pieces are not in place. There's not many, even if somebody came along and said, we are going to build a charter school in Haiti. Okay, so you turn out a bunch of very well-educated Haitians. Then what's your problem?
No jobs.
No capacity. So liberalism in Russia is not going to work. Okay, so then what are your other choices? I'm trying to help that. You've minus out liberalism. So what are your other options?
To move to the Village of Dreams.
Socialism
meaning what?
You provide for them.
Okay, but and does that end up happening in Russia? Sure it does. Mm-hmm. That's called Marxism-Lenin. That's the Bolshevik Revolution. No, but that was ultimately what happened, which was Russia is not going to have an evolution. It's got to have a revolution. That's 1917. That's Bolshevism. By the way, does it work? Not so much? Did they feed people?
Worked for a while.
Yeah, it did work. It worked better than the czars. People went to school, they became literate, they got jobs. I mean, they weren't free. It was Stalinism. It didn't work in the sense that he was a criminal, he killed millions of people. But in many ways, were people better off in terms of having three meals a day kind of thing? Absolutely. So it did work. I mean, it was a choice that we wouldn't make around the whole communism, totalitarian oppression piece, the police state piece. But was it a more dynamic society in terms of industrialization, capacity building, blah, 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 than the czars? You bet. How do you think they beat the Nazis? Some of it was our sending them a lot of stuff, but the point is they were a more advanced industrial society because of communism. They paid a tremendous price for that in human freedom terms. It wasn't like I visited Refusniks in 1986, you'd go into a supermarket, there were no goods there. Like it wasn't what we would recognize as a consumer-oriented society. But, so that's another choice, revolution. What's another choice? What did our families do? Most of the people in this room came from. They ran away. They went to Nova Scotia, or they went to Boston, they went to Cape Town, you know, wherever. The point is they ran away. They said, I'm holding on to the liberalism thing, but the liberalism thing is not going to work here, but it'll work in Canada, it'll work in America, it'll work in, you know, the United Kingdom, in South Africa, wherever. That, of course, is what most people did. They ran away. And Zionism is another choice. That says, what are you going to do for Tevye? You're going to build him a state of his own. Was that the winner in the sweepstakes? No. Most people chose liberalism somewhere else. Because this was the most utopian thing, which is, no, we want to build a whole new society. Like, why would you build a whole new society when your cousin says, I'll send you a ticket, you'll come to Cleveland, you'll work in my bakery? Like, that's so much less psychologically oppressive because you're just dealing with your own little problem. And that's what most people chose. So all these, you know, so people like Hess, you know, he is the dreamer and the planner and the idealist that says, no, but wait, we should think big. This is opportunity to rebuild Jewish society in a totally restructured, re-engineered, revisioned way. Did most people glom onto it? No. Too wild, too wacky. Too idealistic, too ambitious. They went to Cleveland.
Did he just write about it, or did he act on it?
No, he was too early. He didn't act on it. Most of these early guys are coffeehouse intellectual types. Like, they're sitting at Pete's in Leipzig or whatever, and they're talking to each other in their meeting, and they're going to meetings, and they're writing pamphlets, and they're blogging, and, you know, and they're... You know, they're not making a lot of stuff happen. What they're doing is beginning to create the kind of like the intellectual capital for people then later on to go from the intellectual phase to the you guy phase, which is really the most important thing. Because for every, you know, one of you is worth 10 intellectuals. Because what you guys can do in terms of your smarts, your work habit, your passions, your ability to get shit done, is ultimately much more important than a bunch of, you know, intellectuals talking about problems. Like, you ultimately have to figure out, are we going to build Gann Academy or not? It goes from being an intellectual problem to a, like, are we going to build Maimonides, Gann, a summer camp? Either we're going to do that, or we're not talking about it. And I think at this first level, they were talkers. When we get to Pinsker, and then the first Aliyah, then we're talking about people who actually say, no, I'm going to go. I'm going to try to build Zifron Yaakov. I'm going to build a town. I'm going to live there. I'm going to be a game changer. And that's really the first Aliyah. So at this point, we've just been really talking about the talkers. I missed somebody here. Question or comment? Yeah, Karen.
I'm just curious, were other people at this time who maybe were more oppressed in the different societies also talking about...
What, you think somebody's more oppressed than the Jews?
clearly, probably in Russia they were, because that's what would have led to Marxism and Leninism. But, so, you know, were they... Was it just the Jews in Germany or Poland or Sarajevo that were talking about this?
Well, in terms of socialism, what are we talking about? Is there socialist activity in Europe? Huge. There are riots in Paris. There's basically almost like a civil war in Paris in the early 1870s. There's a tremendous amount of class upheaval. And the capitalist folks and the reactionaries, when you mentioned the royalists, this is part of the backstory to Dreyfus in Paris in the 1890s. The royalists, the reactionaries, the church, always the bad guys. The church is super reactionary. I just saw a spotlight the other day. I'm still processing that. The church, the royalists, the liberals to some extent, the conservatives, they're all freaked out about class stuff. And there is, and part of what, the real answer to Karen's question is, the more industrialization you get, the more poor people you get, the more worker types you get, and the potential for labor unrest grows. And by the way, it happens in the United States too. We have sort of kind of airbrushed it out of our history a little bit, but, you know, Rockefeller is infamous, you know, he owns mines in Colorado. There's a lot of labor violence in those mines. We got a Pennsylvania person here. There's a tremendous amount of labor violence in Pennsylvania, the Homestead Strike, other places. Frick, Carnegie, you know, the robber barons. These guys are doing amazing things in terms of Second Industrial Revolution stuff, around stuff like iron and steel, chemical stuff, like amazing technological stuff is happening, at the same time that you have these huge companies controlling the lives of huge numbers of workers, the beginnings of trade unionism. Yeah, there's a lot of battle. And Jews are sort of that's the other piece of Tevye. A lot of Tevyes are becoming workers. They're going from shtetls into cities. They're becoming proletarianized. They go into unions. So there's a much bigger story here around anxiety around labor unrest. And in America, people like Teddy Roosevelt will get involved in this. This is the whole notion of trust busting, like the companies are too big. Standard Oil, obviously the most famous example. People trying to break up U.S. Steel. Standard Oil. So yeah, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety about whether or not society is going to literally kind of come apart because you've got these huge combinations of wealth. That's sort of the J.P. Morgan Rockefeller Rothschild, you know, sort of paradigm. And you have these huge number of workers who are, you know, increasingly taking on a new identity as I am a worker. Because, you know, those of you who are Pride and Prejudice types, or Down Abbey types, you know, you're living in England in 1800, and you're attendant on Mr. Darcy's estate, right, Pemberley. What's your identity? Like, do you feel like, I hate this guy's guts, nothing would make me happier than taking an axe and, you know, splitting his skull open? Like, what's your sense of identity as an English person in 1800 you know, in Derbyshire. You hate your life, you couldn't wait to have a revolution and, you know, burn this guy and his family at the stake. Yeah, you're happy to have a job, but you also have real ties of connection to people. There's a tradition your family's lived on the Darcy property for many generations. Like, those ties are actually meaningful to people. That's a part of the backstory to a lot of what Jane Austen writes about. So part of what happens as people move from the countryside into the city is they become alienated from their work, and they don't live in organic communities anymore, and their identity becomes much more about the shop floor, who's sharing the factory with them. They don't live in organic communities, they don't have neighbors in the same kind of way with rich people. And I think a lot of people are super anxious about that, because what that means is that you no longer live in organic communities where rich and poor people live together. By the way, think about this in terms of space. Shopping space. Where do you guys go shopping? Think about a place like the mall. Who doesn't go to the mall?
Poor people.
Poor people. How come?
Can't afford it.
And that's not just because, like, I can't afford to shop at Lululemon, but also, what do you need to get to the mall?
A car.
It's very different from a traditional shopping space that is downtown, where all kinds of people go. Right, those malls, Paramus, Short Hill, those malls were built for us, to keep the poor people out. Don't kid yourself. Those were privatized, you know, and it's not so different from what we like to make fun of, oh, Boca, gated communities. The malls are sort of like gated communities too. That's a huge change from living in a place like Roxbury or Hyde Park. You go downtown, and you know what? Rich people are downtown in Filene's, and working class people are in Filene's. That's not the mall. So plenty of people are very focused on the world is becoming a lot more segmented, a lot more fragmented. That can't be good in terms of bonds of social togetherness. And I think that is an increasing issue, and I think the socialist piece is a kind of a big pushback around this whole issue of kind of re-knitting people into human community. And again, by the way, I have to say, this is something wonderful about religious community. Ideally, right? A nice religious community, all kinds of people show up there. And this is one of the really wonderful things about, we take this for granted. Synagogues can put out nice kiddushes. Forget about better class. Who else? No, forget about the better class. The opposite. Some people, you don't really know how well they're eating all week long. One day a week, they are getting a nice lunch, and that's a nice thing. That's a real community. That is not an affinity group. That is not a minion of, you know, people went to the same five colleges. They live in the same five streets. That's a real community. Rich people, poor people, ugly people, beautiful people, smart people, dumb people, right? That's what real communities look like. And socialism, I think, was a kind of a way of saying that we were getting away from that. And that's a problem, right? Sarah Silverman's, I don't know if I told you guys this joke, when I used to teach a class in Boca, a man class in Boca,
I met her father in pool in Boca.
Yeah, so Donnie Silverman was in this class, Sarah Silverman's dad, and Jeff Swartz's parents were in this class, and a bunch of other, and the Rudermans were in this class. So I once asked Donnie, I said, oh, Donnie, where do you live down here? He says, $3 million from the beach. Right, like, you know, the point is people don't live together. That's what happens in the world that we live in. So the question is, what impact does that actually have on your identity and your sense of community when the people you hang out with are just like you? So yeah, I think socialism is a kind of a huge response to that kind of fragmentation in Jewish life specifically, and European life in general. All right, questions or comments? All right, let's take a break. And it's now 11:30. We'll spend the last few minutes on Penn State. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about Russia. Is there a, is that an eraser? Okay, right. Well, sort of. All right, so all the things that we've been talking about, we talked a little bit about Semyon. So I want to go back one second just to Russia before we talk, we'll look at Pinsker together. And the first Aliyah. So the I said sort of very quickly that liberalism didn't really work in Russia, but I spoke too quickly. In the sense that the backstory to that, this notion of liberalism is not being likely to succeed in Russia, was that the Russians had tried in their own way to liberalize society. They had done that in a couple of different ways. One was that they did, the Tsar Nicholas I, who was 1825-55, he had done two things. He had tried to draft Jewish kids into the army. From maybe the age of 10 or 12, most kids went into the service at 18 for 25 years. That was the term of service. 18 and 43. He says, Jewish kids can be drafted even younger, and the Jewish community was assigned a certain kind of quota, a certain number of, kids per 1,000. And the Jewish community was tremendously divided about this because since it had to decide which kids would be drafted, typically rabbis' kids weren't drafted, children of rich kids, rich kids weren't drafted. So it was very divisive around this whole question of who was going to be in these regimes. He was trying to make these kids more Russian. And the other thing he built was schools. He built, in effect, almost like modern-day schools. State-sponsored Russian crown schools for Jewish kids to become more Russian, which was a kind of a classic Enlightenment era tool of these states, which is we want to create new identities, new citizens to be members of these new states we're trying to build. We need schools to do that, and they'll learn a trade, they'll learn language, literature, etc. They'll become more nationalized. And, of course, most Jews in Russia did not want to go to these schools. They didn't go to them, I think, for a couple of reasons. If you think about the differences, I keep talking about the difference between Russia and everywhere else. I'll give you three different factors. One is critical mass. There are a lot more Jews in Russia. And a lot of Jews are living in primarily Jewish places. They're living in towns that may be majority Jewish. They talk Yiddish. They have their own kind of linguistic universe. They're religious. They're observant. They really have their own world. So this whole sense of integration into the larger world means something very different when they already kind of have a world. In Central and Western Europe, Jews were a much smaller percentage of people. They felt much more plugged into the larger world. They felt much more desirous of doing that. Second thing is the whole issue I talked before about the social capital capacity thing. There's very little bourgeois society in Russia. In other words, there's very little incentive to go into these schools because they're not going to, that's the Haiti scenario. They're not going to get anything from it. They're going to be forced maybe to make choices about their Jewish identity, and they're not really going to get it. There's not going to be much of a trade-off. And the third thing, this is the least, this is the non-PC thing,
Is the Jews typically in Eastern Europe think of themselves as superior to Gentiles?
They don't really culturally have a worldview that says, well, you know what, I would like to become more like the Gentiles. Like, you live in Boston, and you're a working class kid in 1920, you know, you might think, well, gee, I'd like to be like the Cabots and the Lodges. I'd like to live like them. I'd like to behave like them. I'd like to adopt their mannerisms and the like. You know, you have a sense in a society like England or America or France, I would like to become more like the Gentiles. Like, there's a way in which you really emulate, you seek to emulate them, and that shows up in all kinds of ways. You know, for example, in issues like synagogue decorum, we wanted to behave like the Protestants. Kids aren't allowed to run around. We stopped selling aliyot. Like, we stopped doing all these kind of crazy customs that we felt were somehow undignified and very undecorous. In some ways, that comes from a very deep self-loathing place. It says, you know, we're kind of embarrassed about our own customs. We want to be like the Goyim. And in Eastern Europe, I think that's very much not the case. I think the people didn't feel like we wanted to become like the Goyim. They felt like, look, you know what? You know, the Gentiles were lesser. They were ignorant. They had bad teeth. They drank too much. They were violent. Like, all these stereotypes we have about non-Jews, a lot of those, I think, come from really the East. And, you know, I keep talking about Tevye. You know, Tevye could read. He had a book in his house. He had a prayer book. He had a sense of, oh, Jews study. Like, Jews go to, you know, there's a famous story that a German officer was in Warsaw in World War I, and he was being driven around Warsaw by a Jewish cab driver, and the guy said, oh, would you mind if I need to stop in here for a minute? So he pulls over. The guy says, okay, fine. So the guy runs in, you know, after maybe 5 minutes, he doesn't know where the cab driver's gone, so he goes inside. The guy is Davin Mincha, and now he's studying, he's reading a little bit of Mishnah in this little Mishnah study group, right, which is what Jews do. And they do that across class lines. Like, so the point is, Tevye says, look, you know what, I'm a Jew. I'm a member of this wonderful community with this very distinguished tradition that I'm proud of. What do they have? They have vodka. What kind of culture do they have? So I think that for all of these reasons, the attempt of Russians to integrate Jews really didn't work very well. But it doesn't fail totally. Meaning, they tried to get Jews to go send their kids to these Russian schools. They only get, you know, thousands of people to do this, as opposed to millions. But out of that thousands of people, you get the beginnings of a Russian-Jewish kind of liberal intelligentsia. In other words, people go through these schools, they learn better Russian, they read Pushkin, they're more Russified. Pinsker is one of those kids. The guy who writes Auto-Emancipation. His father was already a Russian-Jewish liberal. He was a scholar. Pinsker becomes a doctor, which is a pretty big deal for a Jew in the Russian Empire. It's a big deal for anybody. He serves as a doctor in the Crimean War in the 1850s with the Russian army. So, you know, he's like a successful Jew. these people felt optimistic when Nicholas I dies and he's replaced by his son, Alexander II. Alexander II is the czar who frees the serfs. And this is kind of happening at the same time as Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation. Like, there's a real sense of excitement about transatlantic, you know, kind of waves of freedom and emancipationist sort of rhetoric. Maybe we're dealing with kind of a new birth of freedom in the world. So Jews are excited about that. They really feel like Jewish life really may change dramatically under Alexander II. And these liberals are super excited about that. They hope Russia will become more like Germany and France and Britain. He ends up not being such a great czar, not because he was so terrible, just because he was not that liberal. He made certain reforms, but not that many. And by the 1870s, Russian Jewish liberals are already pretty feeling like, you know what, not that much is going to happen. Russia's not going to change. He's assassinated by radicals who are pushing Russia to radicalize much more, pushing him farther than he wanted to go. He's assassinated in 1881. There are pogroms that break out. And Russian Jewish liberals, I mean, the question is, how do Jews respond to pogroms? Traditional Jews have a sense of, look, this has happened before, it'll happen again. I don't think they're that alarmed. Some people run away, in terms of emigration, I should say. Some people become communists, some people become much more radicalized. Some people say nothing. And some people turn to things like Zionism. And that's, Pinsker is one of those people who basically says, you know, look, liberalism is not going to solve the problem here because Russia's not going to liberalize. We need to figure out something else. All right, so if you read Auto... Well, first of all, the title, Auto-Emancipation. What does that mean? I mean, literally, you know, define the word. Auto-emancipation, what does that mean?
Do it yourself.
Do it yourself. What does that mean? First of all, what Jews had already been emancipated. They'd already become, you know, citizens of these different states in Europe. So what does it mean to say we're into auto-emancipation as opposed to emancipation? What's the difference?
They can create their own city.
Okay. They can create something themselves, for themselves. What's the problem with emancipation? Because there's a kind of a psychic piece to this as well as a political piece. What's the difference between being freed, someone frees you as opposed to you free yourself? What is the difference? As parents,
you
we...
You have your life, yourself to rely on.
Huh?
That you only have your group to rely on.
Okay. And is that a bad thing or a good thing, Karen? Or just a neutral thing? Value neutral?
I mean, I suppose if you're in Russia and you are auto-emancipated, you have no structure to...
Well, no, forget about Russia. Just think about it. Think about it just kind of categorically. What's the difference between auto-emancipation and emancipation?
Well, it's more powerful. You're taking care of yourself.
Okay. You're freeing yourself? Right? This is the core idea that says, this is a big issue in the black community around Lincoln, around the Civil War, the Union Army. You know, oh, it doesn't feel the same to say Lincoln freed the slaves, or the Union Army freed the slaves, or the North freed the slaves, as opposed to we ran away. We struggled blow for our own freedom. We ran away from our master. We ran away from our plantation. Right? It feels different to feel like, I mean, and what's the downside of when you feel it's kind of like a transitive thing that someone freed you, someone caused you to be free? What are some of the psychological costs that come with that? You might lose it, absolutely. Perhaps it's a contingent, conditional thing. Right? This is sort of like the Purim story. Right? Act 1 in the Purim story, Ahasuerus, good king or bad king of Persia? Act 1, he's good. Jews are at the banquet, right, catered by Milk Street, it's all very nice, they're hanging out there, fabulous. Act 2?
Not so good.
Not so good, because what does he do?
He listens to Haman.
He decides, you know what? I liked you yesterday. And I gave you this and this and this privilege, and then I didn't like you. And I took away this and this and this privilege. So this whole emancipation thing, you could roll it back. I mean, I talk a lot about America. The Supreme Court said a few years ago, well, you know what, the Voting Rights Act, we don't need it anymore in the same way. In Alabama. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but the point is, things don't stay the same all the time just because, like, magically we think they don't change. They don't change. They do change. Things change all the time. So the idea that says a country passed a law, call it the 14th Amendment, call it anything, Voting Rights Act, whatever, and it's going to stay that way forever and nothing will ever change? Nonsense. Look at all this stuff with anti-abortion. There, people are constantly trying to chip away at this, that, and the other thing. Rights are, you can't just assume that rights given will never be taken away. That's naive. So absolutely, people are super hung up in European Jewish life that said, you know what, if the Gentiles emancipated us, maybe they will de-emancipate us. By the way, does that happen?
Yeah.
Where?
In Germany.
Absolutely. That's the Nuremberg Laws. And the fact that they were totally transparent about it is not so relevant. But that was the whole claim that says, oh, you know, Germany went in the wrong direction, and now we, the Nazis, are going to, you know, basically kind of restart German history by undoing all these terrible acts of emancipation and making Jews into citizens. We're gonna take their citizenship away. So absolutely, there's a huge amount of anxiety about feeling like, number one, on a practical level, we may lose our rights. Number two, just the what's the psychic karma piece of that? That says you're feeling like, well, I could lose my rights at any time. Like, what's the karma piece?
Insecurity.
Yeah, total insecurity. Like, every day you wake up thinking, you know, is something bad going to happen today? Kind of thing. So, Pinsker looks at this and says, emancipation didn't work. Because it bred in us a sense of dependence on Gentiles. We're so hooked in to what they think of us all the time. Was that true? Yeah, had to be. Because they're like your parents. They gave it to you and they could take it away. So he says the following. Let's take a look for a second. Did you guys read this? Auto-emancipation?
Yeah.
All right, so what's the problem? Aside from what I said, I'm on page 182 and following. What's the problem? What's the problem that he identifies? I mean, I identify one big problem, which is they weren't freed by other...
That they need a homeland, that they need to flee, and that's part of the whole...
Right. He's a doctor, so he likes talking in terms of, he likes diagnosing people. What's your problem? What's your symptoms? Right? Yeah, I interrupted you, Robin. I'm sorry.
The problem is that they're second-class citizens, he says they're dead,
they're both there.
Good.
Lack of desire,
that's huge.
For 18th century, they didn't live in the West.
Okay. So there are some problems and there are some symptoms. First of all, what do non-Jews think of Jews? How come? They were different.
They were demons.
We're ghosts. We're like a specter. Why are we this sort of ghost-like apparition?
We don't belong.
Because we're sort of like a country in a country. Is that true? Yeah, at some level it is true. Absolutely. He also invokes this sort of, and you guys will resonate with this, he also invokes this notion that says we're always guests, we're never hosts. How do you feel about people you constantly invite to your house, they never invite you? I mean, unless there's some kind of like asterisk, like, you know they can't or something. You feel like they're taking advantage. They can't reciprocate. Right? We're snorers. And he basically says, is there a material basis for Gentiles sort of being freaked out by the spectral presence of Jews? Yeah, because the point is, we don't have a country of our own. A Frenchman and a German, they get together, maybe they don't like each other so much. The French looks down, German cuisine is terrible, like all the sausage, they don't have cook with the fancy sauces, like there's a lot of snobbery back and forth. But is there a baseline of respect? Yeah, because they're both countries, they're both cultures, they're both independent. Like, they have a sense of, yes, Germany's a real place, France is a real place. There's a baseline of accommodation there around mutuality. The Jew cannot be mutual in the same way. We're schleppy. We don't have a place of our own. We lack, they don't recognize us as being a fellow nation in the material, organic way. We're only a nation in the kind of weird, spiritual, a people apart way. We have our own weird food ways, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's problem number one. We're materially different. And we can't, and we sort of lack self-respect around that, and therefore they don't respect us. But now, I think Robin began talking about this, Cheryl, you talk about this also. What's the deeper problem? And then the obvious, and Carolyn, I think you mentioned this too. What's the deeper, what's the thing that's really getting in them? Again, they are his patient. He is doctoring to them. He's administering to them. He's trying to help them. And he says, what's the thing that really gets in the way of them being helped? What's making them such problematic patients?
They don't want to help themselves.
Why not? They don't think they're sick. They're waiting for the Messiah. Okay, this is why this is the single most important essay in the history of Zionism. Because he says at the end of the day, Zionism is about healing a psychosis. You are never going to be well until you recognize the extent to which you are resisting treatment. And the extent to which you are doing that is in and of itself now the disease. We see this with people we love. We say, hey, you know what? The person's got a problem, and they are doubling down on the problem by resisting dealing with the problem. This is what he's saying is the problem with Jews. They don't even see they have a problem. They think, oh, you know what? It's enough for me to be a doctor. It's enough for me to make partner. It's enough for me to do this, that, and the other thing. And what he says is, that's never going to solve the real problem, which is that you don't fit in, you lack self-respect, you're a grubber. You're afraid, you're a coward. And the worst problem of all, in some ways, is upon whom do you cast blame for this? Well, no, you don't do that. Typically, what do?
You blame the
goyim. You're the kid who says the dog ate my homework. And what he's really saying is, stop blaming the goyim. That's why this is so important. Because Zionism, in the most profound sense, is a deeply optimistic worldview because it's premised on the idea that says, you can solve your own problem. And that is about what we try to tell our kids over and over again, which is learn how to become responsible. Learn how to be accountable. If you can figure out how to be brave enough to be honest and to be accountable and responsible, you will be a problem solver in life. And you can do a lot of good things because you're a smart kid, you're a passionate kid, you're this, you're that, the other thing. If you never learn how to be responsible and accountable, you're going to have major problems in life. Because you're always going to be saying some version of, the dog ate my homework. Shit happened to me. It wasn't my fault. Blah, 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 blah. Talk, 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 talk. You want to go through your life? You want to go through your life blaming other people? Be my guest. You're not going to have a very good life. And that's basically what he's saying to the Jewish people, which is, wake up. The less you think about the goyim, the freer you will be. So ultimately, auto-emancipation is an act of self-freedom from what? from yourself. That's the key. You got to free yourself from yourself. Take a hard look at your baggage and deal with it. And this is the beginning. This is the beginning of Zionism as a kind of a mentality, which is, and think about the Israelis, you know, this is like the psychic underpinning to start of nation, which is, hey, become a risk taker, don't be afraid to fail, be brave, own your own life, stop worrying about the going. Stop worrying about Mel Gibson. Stop worrying about crazy anti-Semites. You know, stop. All that stuff is wasted energy. Figure out what you need to do as a Jew, as a Jewish community, as a Jewish nation. Own that. Embrace that. Free yourself. It's going to be painful. It's going to be ugly. But you know what? That's the only way to become truly free. And this is the beginning of Zionism. Is this essay. Because once you get this, you begin to get people saying, okay, actually, I'm going to try something. Like, I'm going to do something totally wacky. My cousin's going to Cleveland. I'm going to go build some crappy little town in Palestine. This is the beginning. We'll talk about Aliyah 1 next time. I'm sorry I didn't get to those texts. Questions or comments? Have a great Thanksgiving. Speaking of freedom. Thank you. Thank you very much.